that the defendant intentionally refused to obey the order of the court, and that's been established beyond a reasonable doubt. I think you have to do that before you get to this. Then does it make sense at that point in the proceeding to say that unless the defendant shows that the default was not willful? I mean, they've already gone through that exercise. So then you wonder, well, what is the meaning of this?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, on page 5 of the bill, of the Hannon-Gross bill, the committee just passed an amendment which said, except as otherwise provided in 161.685. Mm-hmm. So it does set out an alternative procedure in the case. Your Hannon-Gross version,
yeah.
On page 2, section 5.
Oh, page 2, section 5, okay.
Line 27, except as otherwise provided in 161.685.
Proceeding so to impose, okay, then this does reverse the burden.
Yes, it creates a whole different set of standards.
So now then we can, even though we've said we want to have beyond a reasonable doubt proved by the prosecution before you can have confinement as a remedial contempt, we now reverse that in those very situations.
That's correct.
Is that what we really intend to do?
Madam Chair and Senator Shoemaker, the Judicial Department is proposing that whole section be left untouched, basically, and not be subject to these other provisions. So that's what the committee needs to deal with in both of these proposed amendments, whether that should be separately dealt with or not.
So this has to do with restitution.
This
section 27 is dealing with restitution.
Only restitution.
Only restitution.
Madam Chair, and non-payment of fines.
And fines. So it's restitution and fines. And I think that's clear. It is a separate section dealing with it. So you would ask them to have an ordinary standard, if you might. Nori, why don't you comment, please?
Madam Chair, I believe one of the reasons that this provision is written as it is because if you look at subsection 1 of 161.685, a proceeding under this section may be commenced on the court's own motion and not on the motion of a party. It would be quite unseemly to have the court trying to meet some sort of burden of proof.
Mm.
And I think that's probably the basis for this construct.
But still, you're here to say sub 2 is still valid and should be included, even notwithstanding what we've done under the burden of proof on the original piece of the bill.
Madam Chair, yes, we did not intend to propose changes in the current law.
So that's, yeah,
that's a policy decision, certainly, for you. The amendments were originally designed to cover an area that was unclear before as to whether any of the protections under current Chapter 33 applied to proceedings under this section, such as the right to counsel. This amendment certainly clarifies that those rights do obtain, except as otherwise very specifically provided here, and to conform the language to the current bill about confinement rather than using the term commitment or incarceration.
I think it's fine. Okay.
Okay, I guess that's okay. I guess it's a courtesy to Senator Bunn, we probably should discuss it.
I know.
I understand that. I mean, afterwards. He's not here. That's his problem.
He's been in there for a while. Okay. Are there... Ingrid calls my attention to the $25 issue on line 2. I don't know what we have any basis to increase it.
Madam Chair, I believe it represented a basic minimum wage at the time for an 8-hour day at the time it was adopted, but it probably doesn't anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, we just, on that, I guess, are there objections to adopting dash five amendments to substitute section 27A?
Madam Chair, I move the SB 376 dash five amendments.
Okay. Are there objections to Senator Hill's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Okay, one final issue, unless somebody wants to substitute it for the $25. Tired. Carl, you got your final shot at this.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, a little over two weeks ago, the Court of Appeals ruled in State of Oregon, ex rel. Leopold versus McAllister, that a contemnor defendant can assert a constitutional right against self-incrimination under Article 1, Section 12 of the State Constitution in a civil remedial contempt. The net effect of that is that if such a contemnor takes the Fifth or asserts his right under the State Constitution, that the district attorney or whatever agent is prosecuting a contempt is no longer able to prove the violation of the underlying order in the absence of evidence concerning that person's ability. The chief problem that we want to address here is that under criminal procedures now, there's a statute by which you can give transactional immunity, that is, allow someone to be ordered or compelled to testify over their objection, provided that you don't use that in any fashion that will ultimately result in a criminal proceeding. Because the Court of Appeals made this leap and has now considered this particular issue in strictly remedial contempts, we feel that it's appropriate to amend the criminal proceeding, the criminal procedure statute, that would also expand the scope of that grant of immunity to contempt proceedings. And so I have some suggested language that we have discussed with Mr. Ross Shepard from the Defense Attorneys Association, and he has, in fact, made a suggestion which is hand interlineated on the testimony I've just presented. Mr. Wells from the Family Law Section is very interested in this, but unfortunately, because it pertains solely to prosecuting attorneys, it will not be expansive enough to bring into the ambit the types of situations that deal with private civil litigants. Are there questions that I might answer for members? The specific change that we seek is to ORS 136.617, and we're just seeking to expand that from criminal proceedings and proceedings in front of grand juries to proceedings for imposition of a remedial or punitive sanction for contempt. And in 136.619, just indicating that the contemnor can be subject to then remedial sanctions for any information that he may offer. The purpose in this is that under the Court of Appeals decision, basically remedial contempts are devastated by the fact that if we don't have independent evidence, we're not able to prove anything. This at least gives us an avenue to develop other available civil remedies, perhaps a garnishment or a wage withholding or whatever may be necessary. Information that's uniquely within the knowledge of that contemnor we could get to.
And it's primarily in support of enforcement kind of issues, right?
That's correct, Madam Chair. We foresee this being utilized in support enforcement.
Madam Chair?
Senator Shoemaker.
Oh. Boss isn't here, is he? I'm wondering why that, how you react to his suggestion that incarceration not be available as a sanction for someone who has been given immunity and is thereafter prosecuted for perjury, false swearing, contempt, failing to answer, failing to produce evidence. I mean, why should incarceration not be available as a remedy in that circumstance? This isn't incarceration for the Dom Rel contempt. This is incarceration for contempt of court and not producing a record that is necessary
Madam Chair, Senator Shoemaker, the subsequent contempt that is brought because of the failure to answer, that sort of thing, should have its own independent basis of a remedy for a direct contempt of court. So it would come within a summary contempt, I would think.
Why should it not include incarceration?
Frankly, because I think we'd be giving this transactional immunity in exchange for the information that would affect a civil remedy and avail to us assets that were heretofore unknown. I think there's a trade-off there, and obviously it's to the benefit of the support obligee to have that information.
Well, I'm missing something.
I think we're granting the immunity in effect to gain information that will
exactly. And then after you've granted the immunity, then if the witness nevertheless fails to produce the documents, he can then be prosecuted for that contempt.
And that contempt, you're suggesting, should be independent of the underlying
absolutely.
Contempt.
Absolutely.
Yes.
And if incarceration is appropriate to have those documents produced, it should be available. It doesn't seem to me that it makes sense to leave that out at that point.
Okay. I can't argue with that proposition. We crafted this language today, and we wanted to avoid any type of conflict. At this point, it could be resolved as it wins its way from here.
You with me on that? Doing?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Well, maybe I'll just leave it out and go with the bill as it is without this amendment altogether, then, without these set of amendments, and let them work it out.
Madam Chair, would it be possible just to consider an amendment solely to 136.617? I don't think there's any controversy surrounding that.
That's just your sub one.
Yeah.
Sure. I don't think there is any in that. Frankly, we just need to move this bill in a way that.
Yeah. And if we did that, then you just have available to you all the normal sanctions for someone who fails to produce pursuant to order of a court. The previous immunity is then irrelevant to that second proceeding.
To the second
isn't it?
Proceeding.
Yeah.
Yes, I would think it would be, Senator.
I think that makes sense. Just amend 617 and skip the other one.
Okay.
So moved, Madam Chair.
Senator Hill has moved that we, I guess, the, that we have the language. We're really doing sub 1 then, right, only?
Sub 1 only.
Sub 1 only and have it apply to 136.617. Right.
That's correct.
Are there objections to Senator Hill's amendment? And you'll find the words on page 2 of the April 1 written testimony from Carl Stecker.
And you'll find it handed grossed on the attachment to that.
Okay. It is on the attachment at the... Okay, objections to Senator Hill's motion? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else?
Madam Chair, I hope not.
Thank you for all your time.
Thank you.
I think we are ready with this bill. We have taken through all the blue lines. It goes to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Well, Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 376 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Further discussion? No further amendments, we hope. And I do want to say, I want to thank the working group who's worked on this for 2 years and the committee's indulgence for going through these amendments as they change momentarily. And the staff for helping us on the track with some of these complicated technical amendments, but I think we have gone through as much as we can technically, and we're ready to move on this bill. A further discussion? Call roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman.
Aye.
Senator Hamby.
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker.
Aye.
Senator Springer.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Chair Cohen.
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, let's move to... we'll take a bill that Senator Springer has in order. We'll take 373 and then we'll come back to the drive-by. In that order.
Madam Chair, I'd like to pass out some amendments in a gross version of that.
What are we on? I'm sorry.
373. This is the fire insurance policy issue. Heard it a fair amount of time, a long time ago. It was basically Senator Smithville sort of. It's the 1 year, yeah. And you can't move. You can't do it. It's the whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
I don't know, but if I've sort of muddled up by contempt here that I decided to switch to the insurance company jargon about what runs and what doesn't run.
Madam Chair, if I might kind of warm us up to this subject, we do have a couple of people, who are a lot more knowledgeable than I am, including Mr. Olson, who is a member of the bar, who first brought this matter to the attention of the interim committee and to myself. And I would apologize to the committee for the delay in getting this thing rescheduled, but in all candor, it's been due in part to time, I guess, required for folks who registered objections to the original bill to sort of seek and confer and get instructions from their clients. And just as recently as 45 minutes ago, I was advised that the measure that you have before you with dash 3 and dash 4 amendments, I guess, is at least satisfactory to the point that some of those interests, although I haven't spoken with all the interests, will not be objecting to the bill as it is amended. I want to make it clear this is not my first choice, but I think this is about the only choice we have now to. And I wouldn't even represent all the parties feel necessarily bound by this language, but I guess at this point they've at least stood aside, and several of them have indicated to me that the bill is ready to move in this amended form. So I'll allow Mr. Taylor to explain some of the details and the actual language here, but I thought that introduction might be helpful to members and maybe to those who've come down here who would have preferred, as I would have, to seen the bill either in its original form or amended perhaps differently.
Okay. Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Springer, you have before you three pieces of paper. One is the dash 3 amendments, and these are amendments I believe that Senator Springer had worked out with some various parties. You have the rough dash 4 amendments, which I drafted up, and those are amendments that I went back over the minutes the last time and thought that they would make the bill a little bit technically easier to follow. If I could, let me, and then what you have is the engrossed version, which incorporates both the dash 3 and the dash 4. And if I could, going through the bill, this is basically, let me set the policy behind the bill. Currently, all fire insurance policies are required to have in them, as a matter of law, a statement that unless you commence suit within 12 months after inception of a loss, you have to bring suit within 12 months of inception of a loss. What this bill would do, as originally drafted, would say that it requires an insurance company to notify a policy holder by certified mail not more than 90 nor less than 60 days prior to the expiration of the 12-month period of the following. Reason or reasons a claim has been denied. 2, suit must be filed within 1 year of the inception of the loss. And 3, the specific date by which suit or action must be filed. Going to the bill, starting on line 9, it reads, if the insured has notified this company, and I have removed in writing and inserted pursuant to the terms of the insurance policy, so long as these terms are consistent with Oregon law. And that was a result of some comments that Senator Bunn made at the last meeting back in January. Of a loss and the claim has not been paid in full, and then I added, or settled, and that was a result of a comment made by John Paul, the company shall not more than 120 days, no less than 30 days, prior to the inception of the 12-month period, give written notice by mail to the insured stating the reasons the claim has been denied or the amount offered if less than the total amount claimed, that the insured must file suit within 12 months of the inception of the loss or lose the right to collect any money under this policy on the claim submitted. And removing C from the original bill, C, if the company fails to give notice specified, and the 12-month time limitation specified shall be told on the 30th day. And my understanding of told is that once the statute would stop running, once these conditions were met, as it reads on, then you would have 30 days after receipt of notice and the conditions of this bill being met to bring suit. 30 days before the period ends and shall not commence to run again until the company sends a specified notice by certified mail to the insured, and I believe by specified notice, the notice set forth in A and B, small a and small b. Receipt of that notice would start the statute running again.
Okay, we're clear what we're doing here. This encompasses the dash three amendments and the dash four amendments that...
And the dash four amendments would have to be put in LC form.
Yeah. Are there further comments? Anyone else you want to bring up, Senator Springer?
I'll leave it to the parties if they feel they need to make any additional statements.
Okay. Anyone want to comment on the on the amendments that have been offered with respect to Senate Bill 373? Come on up, please, and give your name for the record. Thanks.
My name is Jack Olson. I'm an attorney in Portland. I'm here as a private citizen, not as a lobbyist, not paid by any client. And since I am here and missing the kick or tip-off of the basketball game, I want to say a few words. This may not have any particular impact, but I'd like to speak in favor of retaining paragraph C. And I had a hand in initiating this bill and some hand in drafting it, and it was inspired by a specific case. It was one in which a fire occurred in a business location. There was a property damage claim, and there was a business interruption claim. The property damage claim was resolved within a reasonable period of time. The business interruption itself spanned over about a six-month period of time, and the individual was negotiating with the company without an attorney, and being assured by the insurance company, not to worry, we'll take care of you. In the midst of this, they did send a letter, which basically said you must make a claim within 12 months of the loss. Well, he's thought to himself, well, what's the deal? I made a claim, and he didn't think anything of it. The 12 months went by, and then the claim was denied. There was a lawsuit that did follow, and the court said, well, 12 months means 12 months from the inception of the loss, even though the notice in that case didn't say that. And the argument that, this is business interruption and it should be at least a year from when that ceases didn't carry any weight either. So that's basically what inspired me to say, hey, there's something basically unfair here. Now, this bill does a couple of good things. It specifically says file suit within 12 months of the inception of the loss, but I'm concerned that this inception of the loss, it might be confusing. And that's why I think anybody who's dealt with an insurance company, you know two things. One thing is date of the loss. Who's ever received a letter from an insurance company that doesn't specify the date of the loss? This is just so basic to the insurance company to specify a date of the loss. And it's usually included on all correspondence. So why there's an objection to their specifying what the date of the loss is, when this year runs, I don't understand. It certainly cannot be any burden on an insurance company to include that in a notice. All I'm asking for here is that the average citizen who is paid for insurance be given reasonable notice that the insurance companies, unlike anybody else, can put in its policy that they must make a claim within 1 year. I don't think you can do that in any other form of contract. And I don't think there's any other area other than, well, there's very few areas where there's such a short limitation. And I think it's just fundamental fairness that the insurance company at least inform its own insured specifically of that date when this lawsuit must be filed. Fundamental fairness. Now, subsequent to that case, I've become aware of three more, two of which were people who came after the 12 months had gone by, and I had to say, tough luck, you know, talk to your legislator or something like that. Another one, there had been a law for some lawyers involved, so there was a malpractice claim. But these are four that I'm aware of personally. How many people out there are there who are tripped up by this? By, you know, they've paid for their insurance, and to have something like this result in their not being able to recover, I think, is fundamentally unfair. I can't understand why C is unreasonable. Tip-off time, folks.
Okay, other questions from committee members? Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Well, pleasure of the committee.
Okay, Madam Chair, can we ask, is Mr. Powell still here? Or? John, can I ask you maybe to state your position on these amendments? And if you want to respond to what Mr. Olson commented to, feel free, if I may, Madam Chair.
Oh, please.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies and North Pacific Insurance Company. The amendments pretty much address the issues that we raised at the initial hearing, and we appreciate the courtesy of working with the staff and the senator. The specific proposal that, or the elimination of Section C does not ask us to put the date of the loss. It asks us to inform the insured of a specific date by which a suit or action must be filed. And our objection to that is really at least twofold. One, many of the people handling claims for an insurance company are not attorneys. This is really asking them to make a legal judgment and give legal advice. Secondly, the specific date in this case could be a matter of fact. It could be a question in terms of when the occurrence actually occurred. So what we would have is a claim in which the insured said that it happened. So it might, in fact, be a matter of a question that would need to be decided. Ultimately, it could even be decided by a jury as to when it actually happened. So those are the reasons that we did not want our claims people to have to specifically state a day or a date.
Thank you. Other questions?
Just there are some things that are some range between having them to have to say a specific date and not saying anything at all. Let me just kind of go with it. Is there an understanding then there will not be any opposition to this bill?
Madam,
is this not an orphan, is it? Or
no. Madam Chair, Senator Hill, what we've told Senator Springer, if we come up with a better idea, we will not act on that idea until we run it by him. That would include opposition.
It took me 2.5 months to get there, Senator Hill.
Okay.
Just go with it.
Madam Chair, then
I would move the version of the bill that's been engrossed and read by Mr. Taylor, Madam Chair. Okay. Move those amendments.
Senator Springer has moved Senate Bill 373-A, Hand and Gross, encompassing the Dash 4 and Dash 3 amendments as outlined by Council Taylor. Are there objections to Senator Springer's motion? Hearing none, so ordered.
I'd move the bill as amended to the floor to pass.
Senator Springer has moved Senate Bill 373 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll, please, Kate.
Senator Brockman?
No.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Chair Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Okay, let's move to drive-by shootings. Senate Bill 638.
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask to be excused for.
Right, and when you need the rest of if you give us a send somebody down to
someone's
collect.
Someone's going to come by.
When you at the very last minute that you might need Shoemaker, and then we'll try to get speed along here as best we can.
I don't want to miss yet, Dick, but so.
We've got a couple of.
Is a situation where there is a balancing of competing interests. And these competing interests were all represented in the drafting process. Their views were carefully and thoroughly considered. I might also note that the official comments to Article 4A were prepared by the chairs of the National Conference on Commissioners and Uniform State Laws Drafting Committee, the reporters, with the assistance of the other members from the drafting committee and the members of the permanent editorial board of the Uniform Commercial Code. And while they're not part of the law, they represent a persuasive indication of what is meant by the statutory language. Let me just take a minute and tell you what the major objectives of Article 4A are. To preserve a fast, efficient, reliable system to transfer large volumes of money at a low cost, to provide certainty, and establish the basic rights and responsibilities of the participants. My printed testimony, you will find the basic provisions that favor the corporate users as well as the banks. I will not go into those at this point because in order to be a little bit more brief, but would certainly be willing to try to answer whatever questions you might have. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senator Shoemaker wanted to be here to ask lots of questions, and I would suggest you make a visitation to him when he was interested in the bill. And
thank you very much.
Priority. Anyone else would like to speak to Senate Bill 1187? Okay, let's go ahead and move to Senate Bill 1006, which is sort of, we'll go down our agenda here. Jack Landau is here, and Larry Rue, Bob Olson. Come on up, Jack.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jack Landau, Deputy Attorney General. Hearing this evening on behalf of the Department of Justice. I've distributed copies of my testimony in advance. As you can see, it's brief. I'll attempt to be even briefer this evening. I want to simply say that the department is pleased to support Senate Bill 1006, which has been introduced at the request of the Oregon State Bar. We do so for two reasons. First, we need the legislation to remedy an existing problem in Chapter 180 that we believe precludes Department of Justice attorneys from engaging in any kind of pro bono work. The bar's proposed bill would remedy that problem. Secondly, we think it's important because there is a growing need for pro bono representation for ensuring that legal services are available to all members of society, regardless of their ability to come up with the money for legal services. And we think it's important to make a statement that both public and private sector attorneys have that obligation, and this is a good mechanism for us to make that statement. Beyond that, I'll rest on the prepared remarks that I have and answer any questions that you might have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Nice to have you here on this.
Are there any questions for Jack? Thanks. Thanks for coming. Larry.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm the chair of the Oregon State Bar Pro Bono Committee. It was at our request that the bill was introduced. We are pleased, as you can imagine, that Jack was here tonight to support this bill. We think that it will provide a major, major symbol to the Oregon lawyers to provide pro bono services. And we've been, since receiving comments from the legislature, I think two sessions ago, discussing the issue of mandatory pro bono, the Board of Governors immediately appointed a pro bono committee at that time. It's been functioning since that date. First year, it adopted an aspirational standard. It has been working on projects to get more pro bono services by the private practitioners and the public practitioners, and we think this is one of the major breakthroughs that's occurred since the board appointed the pro bono committee 3 years ago. And we have asked that it be passed, and we certainly wholeheartedly support it, and we think that our committee has worked hard, and we think we're making some progress insofar as making major strides insofar as acquiring additional pro bono services to the people in the state of Oregon. And I'm also willing to answer any questions that anyone might have.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask a question. How do you feel the committee, the Oregon State Bar, would feel about encouraging some of your more highly competent legal assistants to offer the same kind of pro bono work for some of the more mundane, simpler activities?
We haven't discussed that. I know that the issue is before in California. I believe it's before the California maybe legislature at the present time. I've seen some discussion about that. I think my first reaction to that, having not thought about the question, is that that probably will occur, as a matter of fact, as the lawyers begin doing it, because, at least in our firm, we certainly rely upon our highly competent legal assistants to assist us. And I'm not so sure if it starts from that level, it's going to get worked back up to the lawyers, and you do need that service. I mean, there actually needs to be the attorney services, and you end up with a whole broad problem, I think, of, you know, defining a specific area that they can do work in without having a lawyer and having to deal with all the, I think, the management problems of the definition and how do you deal with it, with the ethics of that problem. And at least at this point, I would at least ask that everybody hold back a little bit and see if we can and manage this thing a little more efficiently as the way law firms currently work.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much. Michael Keeney.
Thank you very much.
Madam Chairperson, members of the committee, Mr. Taylor, I'll be brief. My name is Michael Keeney. I'm the executive director of Marion Polk Legal Aid Service based here in Salem. On behalf of the legal services community in the state of Oregon, we urge you to adopt or pass Senate Bill 1006. We thank the support of the Attorney General's office, and we especially thank the Pro Bono Committee of the Oregon State Bar Association.
Great. Other questions? Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Anyone else to speak to Senate Bill 1006? Okay. Move that one.
But on the record, Madam Chair.
Yes.
I'd love to leave a message, one legislator alone, and I'm sure many others would join me, that perhaps the pro bono committee might consider my question and perhaps next session come forward with a recommendation.
Thank you. Great. Okay, let's move Senate Bill 942. Gary Heer is here. This is the Marion County contingent. Bob Cant, you've got
yes,
Bob Cant.
Yes, I'm Bob Cant.
Oh, you are Bob Cant. Gary Heer, you didn't look like Gary Heer. It's late, and I've not seen the full round of Marion County folks again this year, so.
The late hour and the fact that the basketball game will be starting momentarily, Commissioner Heer is unavailable this evening.
I know the commissioner. Is that, we'll send the message back to say how important is this bill really to them,
really. For the record, my name is Bob Cannon. I'm Marion County Legal Counsel, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 942 is a proposal to repeal a specific statute that appears in the County Governing Body section of ORS Chapter 203. Specifically, the bill is ORS 203.115. The statute is one line. I will read it to you. The statute provides that a county governing body shall not change the amount of a fee it has set pursuant to statute within 1 year after setting that fee. This statute was enacted in 1977 as part of a bill that was requested by the state court administrator, then the Supreme Court. The bill provided that the county board of commissioners or county court could not change the county court fees, which the county set back in 1977 prior to state takeover. And essentially, the state wanted the court fees to remain constant from year to year, and then if there was going to be a change, there would only be one change per year. Since the state has taken over the state court system, this statute is a remnant of a previous program, and I think that it's no longer necessary. In addition to that, we have lived with this statute since 1977. It has not been a problem until Measure 5 came in. Measure 5 defines fees as incurred charges. The difficulty with this is that we are required to set fees. In many instances, the setting of the fee on a yearly basis may cause difficulty with having the actual fee in excess of the actual cost, which is required by Measure 5. Primarily, problems are in building inspection, building permit fees, dog licenses, planning fees, solid waste fees, and several others. I have a letter for your consideration from Don Woodley, who is the Marion County Building Inspector. The second paragraph, third paragraph in the letter, sets forth the problem that occurred in 1989 to 1990. Essentially, the state building department charges Marion County a fee. This is a surcharge fee to operate your programs. There was a 40% fee increase in this period of time, and as a result of Chapter or ORS 203.115, we had to take a loss on the increased fees that we had to pay to the state. At the present time, Marion County is working with your building departments, and we are involved in a pilot project which is unique to Marion County statewide. The concept is to have a separate, single building permit program, and as part of that program, we started this in January of this year, and it will go until October 1st, and it's a very innovative program. As part of the program, we were able to reduce our cost by 6%. The difficulty with 203.115 is technically we're in violation of that statute right now. Essentially, we are trying to provide a better service, trying to actually reduce our fees in this pilot program that we have going with the state, and the statute is certainly an inhibition to our ability to help the citizens of the community. Additionally, there is no similar statute for cities, counties, or cities, school districts, special districts, or the state of Oregon. It is a statute that is unique to a 1977 bill. It was put in this location. It's our position that it's no longer needed. We're not quite sure how we get around with our present violation of the statute. We would hope that you would pass it so we would not have to increase fees, which would not be the purpose of what we're trying to do.
Great. Okay. Are there any other questions? Any other witnesses? I think they've all you've explained it quite adequately, I think. And,
thank you.
Thank you very much.
Have a nice evening.
Thanks. Okay, then anyone else who'd like to speak to Senate Bill 942? Paul, where's Paul? Paul isn't here.
Watching a game, ma'am.
Well, that means we can speed along and finish up our work here quickly. All these people there. For the record, Gary here, Don Woodley, whose letter we have, and Paul Snyder, we're all signed up in favor of the bill. So there is no opposition that's surfaced at the moment. Senate Bill 948. We have Keith Burns.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Keith Burns. I represent the Oregon Financial Services Association, which is one of the group's financial institutions that loan money in this state. Senate Bill 948 would change the time within which to perfect a purchase money security interest from 10 days to 20 days. The need for the bill is that in our business community, things become much more complicated than they were at one time. Many of the purchases of today of equipment and such other items are far more costly. Sometimes you're talking about whole fleets of vehicles. You're talking about airliners and various other things. And to get the paperwork done, it has been very difficult. Sometimes it's for unique equipment where the purchaser wants to try the equipment out to make sure it works, and to have that trial period and also have all the paperwork done with 10 days had become virtually impossible. This has been noticed all over the United States, not just here in Oregon. The Uniform Commercial Code, what is supposed to be uniform, has become the exception rather than the rule. It originally had 10 days. And now, there are only 12 states that still have 10 days. All the rest of the states have seen this need to expand it. There are 31 states that have what is proposed in this bill, 20 days in each one of the sections. The remaining have various other days, 15 days, 21 days, 30 days, and so forth. In addition, and there's a list of all those in the material I gave you, our neighboring state of Washington, which we have more commerce than other states, has the same as proposed in this bill, 20 days. The state of New Hampshire has already passed the bill in one house, and it's anticipated to be passed in the other. In the state of Nevada, it has been amended into a bill that it's the least controversial part of that bill, and it is hoped, though, that at least that part been amended into it will be passed. You will hear, I assume, something about the bankruptcy code being different, it being 10 days, and therefore we can't have this difference. For a long time, there have been amendments to the bankruptcy code pending in the Congress of the United States. The least controversial amendment that is proposed is the one to increase that time to 20 days rather than 10 days. There's more optimism this session of Congress than any other time that amendments will be adopted, which would undoubtedly include the amendment to increase that to 20 days. There's no assurance that that will occur, but those that have been following those amendments for many years feel more optimistic now than they have before. Many people say that to change this will cause a trap for the unwary. Most lawyers who practice law feel the whole Uniform Commercial Code is a trap. It's a very technical thing, and only those who are experienced and learned in that area usually do it. We usually associate other counsel. We confront it. I only involved in it once, and the only reason I prevailed in a matter was because I found one lawyer in the state of Oregon knew less about the Uniform Commercial Code than did I. I've never been near it since. Bar is We now have mandatory continuing legal education, as you may know, and they can be well trained in this change, as they do in many. The bar also, at the conclusion of every legislative session, as you know, gives over its whole CLE to the point of pointing out the changes made by the legislature. The PLFA is PLF, the Professional Liability Fund, of which all lawyers must be insured, publishes a document showing the differences in time when things have to be filed and date met, and also has an update, I believe it's quarterly, telling you of different needs that lawyers have for educating themselves on the changes in the law. If we tried to have everything consistent, I suppose that you heard one bill where you have 1 year within which to file a claim to fire. We know in the code you have 2 years for this statute, you have three for the other, you have some almost an infinite number of years. And of course, if you're filing a cause for negligence against the city or other municipality, you have another. If everything was consistent, business people wouldn't have to have lawyers. And in 31 states I've mentioned to you, I have not found any hue and cry that that hasn't served the business community well. And they have the 20-day period, and then there are eight others that have more days than there's 10, and they don't seem to have any great effort to change it back to 10 days. And so to make the Uniform Commercial Code truly uniform, this would be a step in the right direction, so it would be uniform in almost all states. That's the extent of my testimony. If you have any questions, I'd be pleased to try to answer it.
Thank you. Other questions for Mr. Burns? Thanks.
Thank you.
We have Kirk Hall.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kirk Hall. I am the Chief Executive Officer of the Oregon State Bar Professional Liability Fund, and I appreciate Keith's kind comments about our loss prevention efforts. I apologize for not having written testimony. I didn't know of this bill's existence. I was down here on another bill and happened to see it at the table. Believe it or not, this is the third time this issue has come before you this last decade. You'd think that the difference between 10 days and 20 days would not be so hotly contested. I don't have anything against 20 days. I think it's wonderful to give banks more time to get the paperwork done. The problem is, it's not up to me. It's not up to the state of Oregon. The bankruptcy code says that if the debtor subsequently goes bankrupt, you will not have any kind of a perfected security interest in the monies you've advanced to purchase new goods and new collateral, unless the purchase money security interest was recorded within 10 days of advancing the monies. And so this is a trap for the unwary. The original UCC Chapter 9 calls for 10 days, a 10-day period. I can only assume that that was because of the existence of the same provisions in the bankruptcy code, which take precedence over this. Approximately, this section of the UCC was amended in 1983, 85, and 89. I believe 1989 was when we came here with the bill to change it from 20 days back to 10 days. I believe, and I will send you written materials later on this, that in 1985, as I recall, a rural legislator, and I don't remember who it was, brought in a bill. I think it didn't go through either Judiciary Committee. It changed it from 10 days to 20 days because a constituent sold farm equipment and wanted more time to register the materials with DMV or whoever it was. The problem is, again, that legislator, as far as I know, and that constituent had not realized that if the piece of paper was registered on the 11th to the 20th day and the debtor went bankrupt, that's as if they had no security at all in the vehicle or the goods. I really don't understand why the banks are so anxious to have 20 days, because I'm not aware of how they would escape being unsecured creditors as well. And what I would suggest, and suggest to Keith, if they can get the bankruptcy code amended back in Congress to be 20 days, I'll be down here with them supporting a change of our statutes to 20 days. But right now it would create a trap for the unwary. The statute on its face says, as they would amend it, that if you do it within 20 days, you will have a purchase money security interest. Well, you won't. The bankruptcy code will take it away from you if the person who borrows the money goes bankrupt. So why would you want to do this? I don't really understand why the banks would want it, but I can assure you that lawyers did get tripped up by this. I find it interesting at the earlier bill on the wire transfers, the banks were here saying it's a great bill and every segment of the bar likes it and it's uniform in every jurisdiction and it matches federal law. I don't hear them saying that on this bill, and as far as I know, the bar sections have not been consulted on this. The debtor-creditor section hasn't been consulted. As I recall, in 1989, they were very much in favor of changing it back to 10 days. So I guess I would strongly urge you to think this through carefully, because you really are going to lull people, not just lawyers, but there are a number of business people who do these filings themselves when they sell equipment or whatnot, who are unsophisticated, who don't have a copy of the bankruptcy code. They'll get caught up. I suspect some banks will get caught up, and I can assure you that a lot of lawyers will get caught up in a mistake. I'd like the opportunity, Madam Chair, to send some materials about the last bill, which you voted on, I think, 2 years ago, to you, because it raises some of these points in a better fashion. And okay. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Mr. Bronner.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Frank Bronner with the Oregon Bankers Association. As a matter of fact, this is the seventh time that we have addressed this issue since I've been in this building, every other year. And we've gone from 10 to 20, 20 to 10, back and forth. And I suggested 15 days 2 years ago, and nobody listened to me. The way the statute is now, farm implements are 20 days. The legislature amended it last session to provide an exception for farm implements, 20 days. Interstate banking is here, and most of the states are 20 days, so we have a concern to try to have some uniformity, particularly on the West Coast. Now, I used to think that the bankruptcy code said exactly 10 days. I find that a case that is just dated December 7 in Virginia has indicated that GMAC filed, perfected their security interest within the 20 days allowed by Georgia law, and they were protected in the bankruptcy court. Now, that's on appeal, and we don't know how that's going to be decided. This legislature has responded to titled vehicles by providing in the statute a transitional ownership document, which can be done without the benefit of the title and perfect your security interest the moment that you've extended credit. That transitional ownership document has worked very well in this state to address the bankruptcy concern. And I'll tell you this, that anybody that extends credit that doesn't file or perfect your security interest the moment that they get the opportunity, that same day, I just can't understand why they wouldn't do that. So on a titled vehicle where there is a title that may have to come from some East Coast financial institution, we've taken care of that by the adoption of ORS 803-130, which is a transitional ownership document that allows you to perfect your security interest, and it's good for 30 days. And that's only done to respond to the bankruptcy code. With regard to any other security interest that doesn't require you to get a title from someplace else, pray tell me why you would not do it as soon as possible. The 20 days, the bill before you, we support, and we ask that you endorse it.
Okay, thank you. Is there any questions? Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I correct one thing?
Yes.
On March 4th, I wrote the debtor-creditor section and advised them that this bill, although it had not been printed yet, would be in print so that they would not be caught unaware. And also, I'd like to point out there's many things other than the bankruptcy code where this is important. In breach of the term of a contract, the failure to pay when due on a contract, the breach of warranty of a contract, and the lost and destroyed collateral. These things occur much more frequently than do bankruptcies when in a business transaction. And that's so this is not just for bankruptcies. It's for all those types of instances that are quite frequent in the business community.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Anyone else who'd like to speak to 948? Thank you very much. Last bill of the evening, Senate Bill 1108. And we have Phil Goldsmith is here and Marcella Easley from the Division of State Lands. Come on up, Phil. Looks like Marcella's gone.
Thank you.
opportunity to...
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Phil Goldsmith. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. I'm the person that's proposed Senate Bill 1008. As the chair indicated, Marcella Easley from the Division of State Lands has provided written testimony in support of this bill. Because of family commitment, she couldn't, and the lateness of the hour, she couldn't stay to testify. I realize this hearing, well, I should say that Bill Taylor had somebody call me a couple of days ago to say that this bill had been moved from a 7 o'clock hearing to a 5 o'clock hearing, and it turns out that, in fact, we're at a 7 o'clock hearing. I realize this is a late hour. I have somewhat extensive testimony. I'm not certainly not going to read all of it. I'm going to try to discuss some of the more important points. This bill deals with a small and important change in the unclaimed property statutes that relates to class action judgments. And unfortunately, while the underlying concepts, I think, are fairly simple, it's not as easy to explain and deal with as some of the bills you've heard earlier today, so I'll have to say a few things. As some of you may know, I've represented plaintiffs in class actions for more than a decade, both as an associate with Henry Carey's office and more recently as a sole practitioner. I present this bill as a private citizen, that is to say that I am not paid by anybody to do any work on this, and nor am I doing this on behalf of specific clients. This bill would make, as I've indicated, all class action judgments subject to the unclaimed property statute, which would mean that these monies would go into the common school fund, and therefore, in a sense, it could be viewed as a modest step to provide monies for the state to meet its obligations under ballot measure 5 without any expense to the taxpayers. How much money is going to be involved really cannot be determined in advance because it depends on who brings what class actions and what money is unclaimed in those cases. But it would result in probably hundreds of thousands of dollars.
You think it's that much then?
Yeah, I will talk. I've got in my written testimony, I think I may talk a little bit about a case that I've been involved in called Guanasso versus Pacific First Federal, where there's two types of unclaimed monies. Before there was a judgment, there was about $800,000 that was not claimed. After there was a judgment, and while the case was on appeal, another $100,000 was not claimed.